Okay, it's December, and everybody's getting ready for the holiday season. And we have a lot of people who want to celebrate, and we have Kwanzaa, and we have Christmas, and we got a couple other things going on too. But I wanted to share with you the Buddhists have a December holiday as well. And our December holiday is called Bodhi Day. It falls on December 8th each year. And as I thought back to all the Decembers that I went through at IBMC, I had to smile because Reverend Karuna always had a Christmas tree. She loved the Christmas tree. There were lights on it. There were bulbs on it. There were presents underneath the tree. And I often thought that this is her Bodhi tree for December. And in some countries, they actually decorate Bodhi trees to celebrate the Bodhi Day. Now, Bodhi Day is not celebrated by every Buddhist. It's more of a Mahayana tradition, and you'll find it in China and Japan and Korea and Vietnam. And what they did was they took Vesak, which is the full moon day of May, and rather than recognizing three important aspects of the Buddha's life, which was his birth, his enlightenment, and his death, they took his enlightenment day and made it into an individual holiday, according to the solar calendar, not the lunar calendar. So Reverend Karuna picked up on this, and she always celebrated a Buddhist holiday in December with all the other people celebrating their holidays in December. So the Buddhists aren't left out. Now, Enlightenment Day happened for the Buddha when he was 35. He had been practicing for a very long time, and he achieved his full perfection as a human being at the age of 35. And then for 45 more years, he taught his approach to enlightenment nirvana. He wanted people to be able to reduce their suffering and ultimately end their suffering. And he realized he was only human, though he was a perfect human, but couldn't do it for other people. They had to do it for themselves. So for 45 years, he taught how he did it. And those who listened carefully and practiced and had a positive mental attitude and the great faith, as they call it in Mahayana Buddhism, also achieved enlightenment and nirvana. Now, being the kind of guy that I am, I was always confused when people used the word enlightenment and nirvana to mean the same thing. Because if you've studied Mahayana Buddhism, you realize enlightenment is not the same thing as nirvana. So let me go into a little bit of why I think it's different and how I think it's different. So in approaching nirvana, we have three stages. We have the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and the fully enlightened, or the person who has achieved nirvana. So we have four stages, and in your practice, you work through these four stages, and it's not necessarily linear. Sometimes you jump around. None of the stages are forever until you achieve nirvana. So you might achieve something and then you lose it and then you find it again and then you lose it again. And then ultimately when you achieve nirvana, it just stays with you until you die. And the thing about dying in nirvana, parinirvana, nirvana after death, is that you don't have to get reborn ever again. You never have to make the same mistakes twice ever again. You are now in nirvana, not in a rebirth cycle of birth and death, birth and death, birth and death. And in between all that birth and death, there's suffering, suffering, suffering. So you've canceled that out, and now you're just simply in nirvana forever. And people will say, well, what's it like to be in nirvana? And I say, I haven't got the slightest idea, because I'm not in nirvana. So I can only imagine what it might be like. But, you know, when you imagine something, it never turns out to be what it is. You've added your little preferences and opinions and prejudices, and you've created this fantasy, and this is how nirvana is going to be. And then you finally achieve nirvana, and it ain't that at all. So I don't know what it is, but I assume from my reading and from my practice that it's probably a pretty good place to be. Now, I think enlightenment is different, because if you are aware of the Bodhisattva path, you find that you take a vow to be a Bodhisattva until all sentient beings have been rescued from suffering, have ended their suffering, and then you accept your nirvana after everybody else has. So you're sort of driving the bus, and you're picking up people along the way, and they're sitting there, and they're practicing, and then some of them get enlightened, and you open up the door, and they get off the bus, and then more get on, and da-da-da-da, and then finally, there's no one left on the bus but you, and that's the time you get off the bus into your nirvana and live blissfully, peacefully, and happily ever after. Okay, so why don't people who are achieving enlightenment end their suffering and end their rebirth? Because of that vow they took. We're going to save everybody. And how long is that going to take? It's going to take forever. You may never actually get to the end of your practice, because every time someone is saved from suffering, two more people appear who are suffering even more. And the work never ends. It's like with the cats, and Jeannie can tell you this, that you get a mama cat, and mama cat has a litter, and then the litter has a litter, and then the litter has a litter, and life will not be denied. Life has one goal, to be born. And it really does a good job. You know, we've got 7 billion people now. And even with all the pandemics and the diseases and the car crashes and all the accidents and blah, 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 we still have more people being born than are dying. It's amazing how well life works. So now I'm thinking, okay, so you've taken this vow to be a bodhisattva, and you've taken this vow to achieve enlightenment, but what is enlightenment like? Well, you know, again, you can ask a lot of different people and get a lot of different answers. There isn't just one answer, I don't think, to enlightenment. I think there's a variety of answers depending on the person. But this is what I think it is. This is how I've decided it works. That you've been practicing, and you've been practicing, and you've been practicing, and all of a sudden, you come to a place in your meditation practice where self disappears. Not forever, just for a short period of time. That you have transcended personality, ego, the sense of self, and you have reconnected with the universe around you in a very intimate and special way. And what that allows you to see with great clarity is that we are all interconnected and interdependent. Yes, interconnected and interdependent. None of us live separately or alone or independently. We are forever connected with all things around us, the trees and the ponds and the fish and the birds and the cats and the dogs and 7 billion humans. We're always connected to them. We can't run away. We can't put our head in the sand and think it doesn't happen that way or doesn't exist that way. We are always interconnected and interdependent. Now, what that does, what that experience does, I think, is it allows you to see the true reality of the world. That if someone or something, creature, plant, animal, is suffering, there is a part of you that is suffering as well. On the opposite side of the coin, if there is a plant or animal or a human who's having a good day, who feels happiness, who feels joy, who feels connected to the present moment, then there's a part of you that also feels that same joy and connection and happiness. If someone is successful in what they do, there is a part of you that is also successful. If someone is a failure in what they do, then there's a part of you that's a failure as well. But I think what sets the Bodhisattva apart from other human beings who are simply practicing and trying to achieve their own little happiness and joy in the present moment, it is that the big picture becomes evident and we're not stuck. There's always something to do, something to say, some way to help reduce the suffering of those around us. And that's what the whole Buddhist path is about, I think. It really, in the Mahayana tradition, starts with compassion and ends up with wisdom. And I think in the Theravada tradition, it starts with wisdom and ends up with compassion. And sometimes it takes a long time to get to that next level. You know, the thing about compassion is it can be a double-edged sword, that you feel so strongly about the people that are suffering and the situation you find the creatures in, is that you're willing to give away most of your stuff to reduce their suffering, which increases your suffering. Now, the wisdom aspect of the compassion is that we don't give all our stuff away. We have a budget, a compassion budget. And we might say, each week, I have $10 that I can give away that won't affect me in a negative way. And off you go each week with that $10 in your pocket. And somebody says, hey, man, you got a dollar? And you go, sure, here's a dollar. Now you got $9 left. And you continue through your week. And more often than not, you've given up. You've given away. You have forfeited that $10. And people are feeling a little better because of that. And then the next week comes around and you've got a new $10 to give away. So that's sort of linking wisdom and compassion together. You don't want to give everything away, but you want to give something away. And that's the part of generosity that's so important on the Buddhist path. Kindness and generosity. Now, a lot of people are having trouble with money because of the pandemic and the job loss and a variety of reasons. I understand that inflation now has come back and things are costing more than they used to. And every time I go to the store, I sense that's probably the case. And so what we need to do is we need to be very careful in our own life. Because if our life wavers too much and goes into the negative, we'll be of no help to anybody else because we'll be stuck in the survival mode of how am I going to get through the day, the week, the month? Am I going to have enough? Do I need a second job? What's the deal? Blah, blah, blah. We don't want to go there because that really limits our practice of kindness and generosity. So we need to be skillful. We need to be wise in the decisions we make to give stuff away. But say you're in a situation where you don't have anything to give away. You've got no stuff to give away because you're at a minimum of what you need to exist. You have no extra food to give away, and you have no money to give away. And so what can you give? How can you practice generosity when you've got nothing? Well, the one thing you do have, most likely, a little bit of, is extra time. And if you have some extra time, you can share that with people. You can make them feel better because you're willing to sit down and listen to their trials and tribulations. Maybe not offer any answers. There aren't many answers we're going to have because people's lives are very complicated, just like our life. But the simple fact that you're willing to listen, to empathize, maybe even sympathize with what's going on, and have that understanding tone in your voice, that could perhaps be worth much more than the $10 you've budgeted to give away every week. That could be a wonderful gift that people could enjoy and find healing and help in. And you don't have to be a PhD. You don't have to be a therapist. You simply have to be a human being willing to spend a few minutes to listen to someone's story. That's it. And then you leave and you might find another story or another person. And you might find this and you might find that. So let me talk a little bit about meditation and why I don't do mindfulness meditation, but why I do jhana meditation. And then how I even gave that up. Okay, when you study Buddhism, you find there's two kinds of meditation. You find there's mindfulness and you find there's tranquility, which is samatha meditation. And the Buddha did both. The Buddha discovered mindfulness meditation. It had been lost to the world. And every Buddha that has achieved nirvana has rediscovered and practiced mindfulness meditation. But the prevalent meditation technique in India at the time of the Buddha was samatha meditation. It was tranquility meditation. It was going deep into jhanic, I don't want to say trance, but deep into highly focused states of mind. So there's something called the four jhanas, and the first jhana has five characteristics: applied thought, sustained thought, happiness, bliss, and equanimity. And what we find in that is we find applied thought, taking your mind and attaching it to the object of meditation, which could be simply the sensation of breath at the tip of your nose, and holding it there. Applied thought and sustained thought, not letting it go, tethering your attention to the tip of your nose and feeling the sensation of breath. Then there's happiness, bliss, and equanimity are three of the characteristics that arise because of applied thought and sustained thought. When we go into the second jhana, we get rid of applied thought and sustained thought. Now we have happiness, bliss, and equanimity. We have trained our mind to simply rest on the object of meditation, the sensation of breath. So we have a stronger sense of happiness, a stronger sense of physical bliss, and the beginning of balance, equanimity of the middle path. Okay, if we want to go even deeper in our concentration exercise, what we need to do is get rid of something. Because Buddhism is not the path of accumulation. Buddhism is a path of renunciation. We give up stuff that prevents us from realizing that we are already there. So we don't have to go anyplace. We don't have to go to the ashram in India or the mountains of Tibet or to Pacoima. We simply need to be in the present moment and the experience of our life. Okay, so what do you give up next? You give up physical pleasure. You give up your attachment to physical pleasure. Physical pleasure happens because you have a body and a mind. It's just that's what happens. Okay, and we get attached to that. And we want to re-experience it over and over and over again. And we'll go through so many different gyrations and places and things to do just to get that bliss one more time, that bliss one more time. It's addictive. This pleasure and bliss is addictive. But now you've figured this out. You figured out, you know what? If I can get rid of some of my attachment to physical bliss, I can get rid of my aversion to physical pain. Because pain and bliss are two sides of the same coin. So if you've tried to give up your aversion to pain, it's very difficult. Because pain just is just like bliss. It just sort of happens, and there it is, and you're stuck in it. And unlike bliss, which leads to more joyful life, pain leads to a very uncomfortable life and ultimately death. So if we can balance that out and say, okay, I'm not going to have this attachment anymore to this physical pleasure, this physical bliss, and I'm going to have less aversion to my physical pain and discomfort, that allows me to go into the third jhana, which now has happiness and equanimity or balance of mind. Okay, so now we've realized that in order to get to the next place, we have to give something up. And we don't want to give up balance. We don't want to give up equanimity. We don't want to give up peace. But what we want to do is give up our attachment to happiness. And the other side of the coin with attachment to happiness is aversion to sadness. And so many times if we find ourselves in situations that make us sad, we feel that there's something wrong and we shouldn't feel the sadness of the situation. Well, but we're human and we can't hide our head in the sands. We have to face that sadness and look at it as being always temporary. Always temporary. That the sadness and the happiness never last. They always end and something else takes its place. Now, if you're sad, more sadness could take its place. And if you're happy, more happiness could take its place. But usually we go from sad to happy to neutral to sad to happy to neutral to happy, neutral, sad. We're just going over all this cycle of happiness and sadness. And then finally, it starts again, and it starts again, and it doesn't seem to ever end. But this meditation practice is allowing us to see where it comes from, allowing us to see our attachment to happiness and our aversion to sadness. And once we figure that out and figure out how to let that go, how to let go of the happiness, the attachment, the sadness, the aversion, we're now in the fourth jhana. And the fourth jhana is perfect balance of mind, equanimity, not indifference. There's still an aspect of caring that goes along with that. Because if we come to a place of indifference, we might feel it doesn't really matter if I live or die, eat or not eat, drink water or not drink water. None of it matters anymore. We get into this sort of nihilism, this sort of darkness, if you will. And equanimity is not dark. Equanimity has the brightness of wisdom and compassion associated with it. Okay, so here we are now. We're at the fourth jhana, and we have no past, and we have no future, and we have no pleasure, and we have no pain, and we have no happiness, and we have no sadness. And there we are, peaceful, balanced, in the present moment. And that is the mind state that the Bodhisattva uses when they go into a variety of situations to be of service to others. They are not affected in the same way that the people who are suffering are affected. They're not affected in the same way as the animals and creatures are trying to help and reduce their suffering. They're not affected not because they're indifferent, but because they have equanimity, which came out of their meditation practice. So when I sort of figured this out, and this is all sort of, you know, something that came to me over a period of months and years, I thought to myself, that's what I wanted. I want that. You know, I don't want so much mindfulness that I'm critical of every situation I find myself in. And oftentimes after months and years of mindfulness, there was this sort of critiquing going on all the time, you know? And it didn't lead me to any place that felt comfortable and at ease and at peace. And then I found this samatha meditation and the four jhanas and going into deep states of one-pointedness, deep states of one-pointedness, which allowed me to free myself from a multitude of opinions and preferences and prejudices and simply rest in the present moment without having to evaluate it, but seeing suffering and seeing the end of suffering and seeing how those two are connected and how I could be useful in connecting those two for people and creatures and all sorts of things. Trees and flowers too. So there you go. That's like Bodhi Day is we're celebrating this enlightenment of the Buddha. Not so much his nirvana, but pretty much his enlightenment and his 45 years of teaching as a Buddha, which is the ultimate goal of every bodhisattva, is to become a Buddha. Now, when I first read that, I thought, how's every bodhisattva going to be a Buddha? Because there's only one Buddha at a time on earth. And we already know who the next Buddha is going to be. And so we haven't got any place to go if we are bodhisattva and want to be a Buddha. But then in reading some of the Mahayana texts, you can be a Buddha on a dust mote, a little universe of dust floating through the air. And there are creatures, probably very small and hard to see, who are suffering, and that could be your calling, to be a Buddha on a dust mote. So you continue, even after you're a Buddha, you continue with this idea that, okay, I've done my part, I am now a Buddha, I am now going to accept nirvana, and behind me are hundreds of thousands of millions of bodhisattvas who are still working and practicing and being of service to others, who are practicing generosity and compassion. Okay, now, I'm on Google and I Bodhi Day and what have we got going here? And I found something that was really nice. That these are three vital lessons that can help us on Bodhi Day. So it's December 8th, which I think is next Wednesday. That's Bodhi Day for us Buddhists. That's our Christmas. Get those lights on your Bodhi tree. Okay, number one. Lessons from Bodhi Day are simply priceless. It teaches us how to find meaning in our life and to live out the best part of ourselves. Meaning in our life and to live out the best part of ourselves. I thought, yeah, you know, because we all have these good parts and these bad parts. We all have these parts we're proud of and we're sort of, then we have the other parts that we're sort of embarrassed about that we still, you know, haven't achieved nirvana yet. We haven't even achieved enlightenment yet. We much prefer, you know, chocolate cake to rice cakes. And you just go, wow, will I ever get to the place where rice cakes are as good as chocolate cake? I don't know. But the best part of ourselves, can we live that one day a year on Bodhi Day? Bodhi Day also deepens our spirituality. Everyone needs spiritual awakening and deepening to be able to live meaningful and purposeful lives. This day offers a platform to get a great deal of that deepening. So oftentimes, if we live around a yoga center or meditation center, Bodhi Day, we'll spend some time in meditation or doing yoga. We'll spend some time reflecting. We'll spend some time in charting out the course we've chosen, our spiritual path. And it gives us a time out where all the secular stuff we're involved with all the time. You know, now we've got a day we can dedicate to spirituality. And more importantly, to our spirituality and our practice and our path. And the last one, it unites us for the common good. One of the highlights of Bodhi Day is performing kind acts for other beings. This unites diverse people to do good things together. So this could be our kindness and generosity day. You know, instead of, you know, $10 for a week, how about $10 for the day? Or instead of 10 minutes a week, how about an hour today that we can share with someone who needs someone to listen to them? This is, and it also brings us together. Remember what I said when I'm talking about, you know, one of the aspects of enlightenment is that personal realization that we're all interconnected and interdependent. This is the day we're all working together to make this planet, to make this community, to make ourselves just a little more compassionate and wise and generous. And in that working together, we can understand that diversity creates community. It's not the other way around. Diversity creates community. And what Buddhism says, according to me, is that the idea is not for all of us to be one. The idea is for all of us to be ourselves, but to be connected to everyone. To be connected to everyone. That way we don't lose our individuality, and the common good of the group is upheld and practiced. Bodhi Day, December 8th, 2021. And for those of you who haven't been to my Facebook page in the last couple days, yesterday I posted a Buddhist calendar for 2022. I know, it's almost here. A couple more weeks, 2022. So it's a free Buddhist calendar for the wall in PDF. All you have to do is download it and then print the page. And you can put it on your wall and have a Buddhist calendar for free.